Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Margaret Talbot, whose book is titled The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. Margaret Talbot is the daughter of Lyle Talbot, and this book is about Lyle Talbot. She's a staff writer of The New Yorker, has been since 2003, former editor at The New Republic, contributing writer also at one time, New York Times Magazine, one of the founding editors of Lingua Franca. Margaret Talbot, your dad, Lyle Talbot, was a, I guess you'd call him a contract player in the 1930s in Hollywood. He was an actor who went from being almost on the verge of stardom down into the dregs, was in one of the greatest bad movies of all time, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and was also for, I think, 13 years a regular on a show called The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. When did you conceive of the idea of writing a book about your father, and rather than make it a biography, look at it as kind of a social history of American pop culture?
You know, I think growing up, I heard all these stories that my dad would tell because he was a storyteller, a holder forth at the dinner table. And like all kids who have fathers like that, I think I tuned out a lot of the time, but I tuned in some of the time. And as I got older, and especially after my father died in 1996, I think I started thinking about his stories and about how kind of when you strung them all together, they really told this bigger story about the history of entertainment, the rise of mass entertainment in the 20th century, because he started in these little touring carnivals and magic shows and touring tent theater throughout the Midwest in the teens and 20s. And then he came out to Hollywood in the early 30s and kind of the heyday of the studio system. And then, as you say, had a sort of dive into the depths of B-movies and exploitation films in the 50s, early 50s. And then by the end of the 50s was a stalwart on these family sitcoms and part of the beginning of TV as a fixture in American homes. So, you know, his story told a bigger story. Why I didn't do a straight biography is partly because he wasn't, you know, a star of the caliber, you know, a Spencer Tracy or a Katharine Hepburn or a Humphrey Bogart who would warrant a full biography. But in a way, that gave me a lot of freedom because I didn't have to write a comprehensive book. I didn't have to touch on every film he made, and he made some lousy films. I could use him as like a narrative thread that would take me through this history rather than make him the center of it.
But there was an organizing principle. At one point, you had to sit down and say, okay, what's my father's life from 1902 to 1996? How am I going to organize this? Did you have like a timeline chart?
Yeah, I did. That helped. And also the fact that he left an incredible collection of scrapbooks, and they were very organized, you know, by sort of decade and aspect of the entertainment business that he was in at that time. And that actually gave me kind of a spine to work with that was quite useful.
When I was thinking about Lyle Talbot, and I was thinking about, okay, who would play him in a film? And the answer was, I mean, it sounds like it would be the answer, but it's kind of a weird answer. The answer would be Lyle Talbot. In life, he was the guy who lost the girl up until later in life.
Exactly.
You know, if he was going to be played by anybody else, it might be Ralph Bellamy.
Ralph Bellamy, right, right. Always the second lead, yeah, the other man.
And he never quite became a star. But by the time you came along, how did you figure out who your dad was?
There were a lot of things I didn't know and things that I found out in the course of writing this book. For example, I knew that he had been married. We all knew, all my siblings and I, that he had been married before her mother to other women.
Did you have a number at that
well,
point?
Well, had no, did not have a number. Was a little vague on that, you know. There were some earlier marriages. And it turned out he was married a total of 5 times, that my mother was the 5th. And she was the one who lasted. The other marriages were brief and did not produce children. My mother, who was 26 years younger than he was, the marriage at the outset did not seem like a promising one, was actually the one that worked and stuck and became a great love story for them both. That was something that I didn't know. He was an actor, so he was very careful about his self-presentation and in many ways very vain, although I've come to kind of respect some of that vanity in the course of writing this book too, because he used it really to make himself so kind of lovely and presentable for every time he went out of the house, including to the grocery store. So I knew what he told us, which were these stories. And he would tell a lot of stories about his showbiz years. as I looked into them, because, of course, I had to treat this as a researcher or a historian, what was impressive to me was that they checked out. You know, I was able to confirm them. You know, I did a lot of research in movie archives and reading, of course, and was able to sort of find out that his memory was as sharp as it appeared to be and, you know, pretty accurate.
Margaret Talbot, when you were growing up, when you were very young, he had a day job, and the day job was working on Ozzie and Harriet. So when you were growing up, he was a working stiff on a TV show, right?
Yes. I was born in 1961, so he was on the Ozzie and Harriet show in the late 50s and into the early 60s. At that time, in the 50s and early 60s, my brother, Stephen, was also on a sitcom, Leave It to Beaver. So the two of them would head off to work in the morning in the family station wagon to, you know, go enact the family ideal of, you know, the 50s in America.
Do you remember them driving off in the morning, or is that just before your memory?
You know, vaguely. You know, they both continued to act. Well, my father did on TV, all kinds of TV, guest spots on TV. So, yes, you know, my father loved to work. So I can remember the feeling of sort of anticipation and excitement when he got a job, because he was essentially, you know, a freelancer, as many actors are. So, you know, when the agent called the house, that was a red letter moment. You know, you dropped everything to say the agent's on the phone.
Margaret Talbot, in your research, things you didn't know, what surprised you the most about your dad?
One thing was just an appreciation of a quality that I think is meaningful to me as a writer, and, you know, that I gained a new appreciation of and a new kind of insight into, which was that, you know, he was somebody who worked in a creative field where there's a very visible hierarchy, a very visible star system, and he did not become a star. You know, in the early 30s was being touted as a star. It was like Clark Gable was how he was often, you know, played up. But he worked all his life as an actor, so he was somebody who did not have to do anything else to make a living. That was a real point of pride for him, and he felt very lucky. So you could imagine having a life like that where friends of yours are becoming stars and you are not, and you become bitter, right? And I think that does happen to a lot of people.
And you didn't suspect that before you went into your research that that would happen? That you'd see that?
Not really, because I didn't realize how touted he was in the early 30s as a potential star. I mean, I found a lot of these clips from movie magazines that would say, you know, the two stars of tomorrow, female star Katharine Hepburn, male star Lyle Talbot, watch for them. So you get more of a sense when you go back in time of the contingencies of history and how things could have turned out differently. So he definitely had a moment when he was kind of on the verge. So that was one reason. And also, I think it strikes you again when you spend time in the sort of voice and head of a parent or a close family member, and you try and be a little objective, that qualities about them become more visible to you. So that quality of feeling lucky that he lived the life he did instead of feeling bitter that he didn't have the life he could have had is one that I, as a writer in a world of journalism that is equally uncertain and even more uncertain, sort of value and have taken to heart, I think.
Did you know that he was that kind of playboy?
Yes and no. I mean, I did know that he was a playboy. Once I was looking around in our garage and I found this picture of some blonde bombshell actress, I don't know who she was, cupping her breasts, and it says, and it's inscribed on it, "I'm holding my own till you get home." And it was obviously something she had sent to him. And I remember I was, you know, maybe, I don't know, 13 or 14, and thinking, you know, who is this? What's this about? And I remember once reading a clip that he had in an old scrapbook that described him as having been catnip to the ladies. I knew that, but I didn't know the extent of it, and I didn't know much about the lives of some of his former girlfriends, which turned out to be pretty interesting.
The bulk of the book takes us way beyond Lyle Talbot, Margaret Talbot. It takes us into a lot of areas. The life as a carny, just past the turn of the century, life as a magician, early stage life, you know, we know about the stage in modern times and the stage, you know, what it was like in the beginnings in the 1800s. But the early part of the 20th century, when film was just coming in, but it hadn't quite penetrated, that was a completely different world that your father was part of before he went to Hollywood. And then, of course, you've got the Hollywood years. He was instrumental in founding SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and you talk a lot about when he could have made a dent, which was the pre-Code era, and then, of course, later on, what it was like in the 50s, being a TV second banana. And each of these you went into, were there any areas that you were thinking of going into but then decided that's just too far afield?
Off the top of my head, no, because what I felt I was able to do is sort of, with each of these phases that you described very well, I was able to sort of pull a thread and follow that. So, for example, yeah, the whole period of those traveling theater troupes, which was, it was this moment where there were movies, but lots of small towns didn't have movie theaters yet. And so when these traveling theater troupes came to town, it was a huge deal. It was, you know, bringing news of the outside world. It was bringing news of glamour and city life in the plays that were performed. And at the same time, people had a very ambivalent relationship with actors, with show people. I mean, my father used to talk about going into many towns, particularly in New England, actually, where, you know, actors were not permitted to stay in the local hotels. It would, you know, no show people allowed, or where they would stay in a hotel, they would be allowed, but when they ate in the dining room, there would be a curtain drawn to separate them from the decent folk who were eating in the same hotel. So people were beginning to be fascinated by the idea of celebrity and glamour and personality, and but at the same time, there was a lot of disapproval that was still very obvious and intimate. In fact, that was the era that first got me interested in writing about him, because I felt, as you say, that it's a little bit of a hidden time frame that we don't look at quite as much.
What's curious to me is that you don't mention vaudeville, which was also at its height at the time. This is pre-burlesque. Vaudeville itself, he was never involved in vaudeville.
Right, because vaudeville, I think, was centered a lot in big cities. A lot of it involved ethnic comedians and performers, and so places like New York and Chicago were very big for vaudeville. Later on, he would go to New York and be on Broadway, but in that era, he was really traveling around Nebraska and South Dakota and North Dakota and Colorado, and so it was a different scene. Yeah, a scene that we don't read about as often, and yet I think it did have a big cultural impact, because a lot of the plays they were doing were these plays about, you know, flap and divorce and the difficulties of prohibition. So these were plays that were being brought to kind of a small town audience and kind of exposing them to big city values.
Margaret Talbot, I remember growing up in New York and going to the Archeo Keys, which was built in 1928, and its shell is still there. I remember that the popcorn stand seemed a little out of place, which was odd. And it turns out there were no popcorn stands when the movie palaces were built. Did you know that?
Not till writing this book. No, I did not know that. Yeah, I was fascinated by that. The early movie palaces, they really wanted to uphold the idea of movies as art and movies as a refined entertainment. So they wanted to draw a distinction between themselves and carnivals and circuses where you did have popcorn. So they didn't serve popcorn. They didn't serve snacks. And the tickets, there was a pricing structure more like in a theater. You had different prices for different areas of the theater. And they were built, of course, to look like these fantastical palaces, not to be sort of precursor of the multiplex.
And they were also huge, which is a problem in restoring them, because what do you do with a 1,300 or 1,400 or 1,500-seat theater?
Exactly. Gorgeous stuck. As they are, they're cavernous. Yeah.
Did you go to Brainerd?
I did, yes. Brainerd was a really small town when he was born there in 1902. It was mostly Czech immigrants. It was kind of like Willa Cather territory. It's near Lincoln, but it's kind of off the beaten path. It's not on a railroad line anymore. But they really honor his memory there and have maintained archives on him. So it was very useful in that way to go there.
Speaking of small towns, Hollywood itself, when he finally signed a contract, which was, what, 31?
32, yeah.
32. Mm-hmm. When he finally signed a contract, it was also a small town. A couple of things about that got me. One was that these movie stars, all of them, had no clue that they were stars. They were just working actors, and it wasn't until they toured America or stopped in somewhere and were mobbed, and they were stunned.
That's right. You sort of forget, you know, when you didn't have commercial air travel, how far away the East Coast was, or really any place else felt from Southern California. So it, and you know, they called it the movie colony, and it was like a colony. It was, you know, kind of unto itself. So yeah, and you know, a train trip would take 5 days or more to go back east. And my father used to describe how Hollywood felt, as you say, like a small town, and you would stroll down the street, and you wouldn't be bothered by tourists or fans, and you would go to the same you'd go to Musso and Frank for lunch, and you'd go to the Brown Derby, and you'd see the same people, and, you know, you'd go to the same barber shop, and go to the tailor, and he remembered waiting outside the tailor where Greta Garbo was getting her first suit made. You know, it was a man's tailor, and he was told, you can't go inside because Miss Garbo is in there, and he wondered what she was doing in there, but she was scandalously getting pants made. And they were all working incredibly hard, too, because it was that system, especially at a place like Warner Brothers, which was a very cheap studio known for that. So they were working all the time. Yeah, so, for example, in 1933, my dad was on this train trip, the 42nd Street Special, that Warner Brothers sent back to Washington for the inauguration of FDR, because they'd gotten on board with FDR in a big way. And, yeah, and they would stop in these towns, and it was sort of a whistle-stop tour, and they were amazed at the number of people who came out. And they realized, I think, then, oh, we're movie stars. We're this thing called movie stars. We're something, we're a new phenomena. Yeah.
People wanted to be movie stars, but being a movie star, a contract player in particular, but all of these people, their working conditions were absolutely horrendous. They were working 6-7 days a week, because they weren't supposed to work Sunday, but they often were working Sunday anyway. They were loaned out. There were no vacations for them, working 14, 16-hour days, sometimes on three projects at once. You tell the tale of your father bicycling from one to another with the script in front of him, trying to keep track of what the hell he was in.
Right. That's right. He'd have the script or two for the current projects he was on in the front basket of the bike, and the script or two for the next projects in the back bike. You didn't necessarily know, you know, yeah, what role you were going to be in next. Of course, you had no real choice in it. You were assigned roles. And that was actually what led for him to the feeling that they needed a union, because it more even than the pay or anything, it was really that the studios owned their time to this kind of extraordinary degree. And of course, it was the Depression, and the studios, at first you always hear about how people continued to go to movies during the Depression, and they did, but initially, you know, after the novelty of talkies wore off, there was a year or two where they were struggling, and so they were cranking up production to try and compensate. It was a magical world in certain ways, and an incredibly hardworking world in others.
I guess the only time for freedom would have been at night, going off to marathon dances or nightclubs,
mm-hmm.
or getting laid.
And there was a lot of all that. There was, of course, you know, as we've all read and seen, you know, a very lively Hollywood nightlife at places like, you know, the Trocadero and the Coconut Grove, and a lot of famous fights, a lot of famous romances starting. And also, of course, some of that nightlife was also work in a way, in the sense that the studios would send you out with a particular starlet, for example, or a particular star who they were trying to promote, so that you would be caught unawares by the photographers, and studio photographers would be sent out to get your picture. So, you know, some of the time, of course, it was arranged in a way, but that doesn't mean it wasn't fun, and I'm sure it was a lot of fun. I know my dad had a lot of fun.
He also went up to Hearst Castle. Did he talk a lot about that, or was that mostly research?
No, he actually talked a lot about that, because I think for people who got to go up there a few times, that really was a kind of extraordinary memory, just the way you would be sort of summoned. I mean, his connection was Marion Davies, who he was friends with, who, of course, was the longtime mistress of William Randolph Hearst, and an actress and very talented comedian, actually. And her invitation would arrive at your house. You would be picked up by a limousine, taken to the train station. The train would take you up to San Simeon. He used to describe just the freedom of it, because you were just expected to show up for dinner, and you sat at the long refectory-style table with the ketchup bottles, because Hearst liked his ketchup bottles on it, and you dressed for dinner, and a word would come out, whether it was formal dress that evening or what level of dress you were expected to show up in. But other than that, you had free run of the place, including, you know, the private zoo, the horseback riding, the, you know, wranglers on staff. He did a lot of sneaking. My father did a lot of sneaking of drinks with Marion Davies, because Marion Davies had a drinking problem, and Hearst tried to restrict the alcohol to some extent there, and it didn't work, because Marion Davies was so charming and had friends on staff, a butler or two, who would sneak her alcohol, and they would meet, the drinking group would meet behind a little column somewhere and get a snootful.
You write a lot about gay issues in The New Yorker. Did your father ever bring that subject up about life in the 30s, or as a straight actor in an era of repression, he didn't know anything and he didn't want to know anything?
I think more of the latter. You know, obviously in Hollywood and in all phases in the theater, he knew a lot of gay people. And I think he knew they were gay, but he didn't talk about it. Yeah, that was kind of the style of the day. A lot of them were good friends, and so you always wonder about that now, you know, how could they be good friends and this not be a subject of discussion? Maybe it was, and he didn't talk about it. I never heard him make what I would call an anti-gay remark. Neither would he say, you know, oh, so-and-so and his boyfriend is coming over. It was that kind of unspoken, we know this, but we're not going to talk about it. He did talk about, for example, Ed Wood being a cross-dresser. We knew that. Ed Wood, who my father actually was pretty fond of. He thought he was quite a sweet guy. And in fact, when the Tim Burton movie came out about Ed Wood with Johnny Depp, and Johnny Depp plays him as this kind of earnest guy who really believes in what he's doing, you know, my dad thought that was a very accurate portrayal.
Really?
He did. He was very fond of Ed. But one evening after the premiere of, which I can't quite imagine, the premiere of one of these movies, would have been a kind of fascinatingly tawdry, low-rent evening, and I wish I could have been there. So it was Glenn or Glenda or Plan 9 from Outer Space. They both had a lot to drink, came home, drove home together, and Ed couldn't remember or couldn't tell my dad where he lived or where he was living at that time. I think he probably moved around a lot. And so my dad said, oh, you can just sleep it off in the car outside the apartment, and went inside to where my mother was. And my mother, who was very soft-hearted, said, oh, you can't leave him, you know, out there in the car, bring him inside. She'd never met him before. My father brought Ed Wood in, and she said, oh, he can have our bedroom. We'll sleep in the boys' room. So the next morning, they were sitting around the breakfast table, and my mom was there. And my mom was 26 years younger, and my father had this kind of protective feeling towards her. And they were sitting there with my brothers, who were little boys at the time. And out Ed Wood comes, and he is wearing one of my mom's negligees that he has found hanging evidently on the back of the bathroom door. And he was a cross-dresser, and I guess kind of a compulsive one, so he saw this and couldn't resist. And my father, who maybe knew about the cross-dressing aspect, I mean, Glenn or Glenda is a very autobiographical film for Ed Wood, but maybe my father didn't quite get this. The idea that there he was standing in the kitchen in his wife's negligee was actually too much for my dad, so he said, you're out of here, Ed, I'm sorry.
What did he think of Ronald Reagan as governor of California?
Not a fan, I would say. You know, my father had gone through a period of being, for most of his life, kind of apolitical, politics not preeminent in his mind, traveled around a lot, didn't have the sort of local sense of politics that you get if you live in one place for a long time. You know, and was a founder of the Screen Actors Guild, so that was obviously a political role. But by the 50s, I mean, I think he was caught up a little bit in the sort of anti-communist feeling in that era.
Did he talk about that at all?
This would have been when my older siblings were young. By the time I was around and conscious of him as a political person, my mother had done her magic on him, and her kids had, and he was a liberal Democrat. But he was a supporter of Nixon as a congressman in the 50s, and, you know, was concerned about the communist threat. But gradually, over the course of the 60s, and my mother had always been a liberal Democrat and was had a big influence on him, so he sort of converted. So that was the dad I knew in the 70s and 80s. Ronald Reagan, you know, I think in the way that somebody you've worked with who you think is a fine person, but, you know, you don't have a huge amount of respect for them, maybe, you know, and then suddenly they're president of the United States, you know, it was that kind of attitude. It was like, are you kidding? Ronald Reagan, really?
He would have known Reagan pretty well because Reagan was one of the leaders of SAG at one time, too. So they knew each other pretty well.
They knew each other, yeah. They were never close. They were never at the same studio. I would say they were never friends. My father's era of greatest involvement in the Guild would have been in the early years, in the 30s, and then Reagan's more in the 40s and 50s. So there was some overlap because my father continued to be involved in the Guild, but not, they weren't, you know, close allies or anything like that.
Well, I noticed you kind of gloss over the 40s once he got out of the war. His career kind of took a downward turn, but you don't really go into the hows and whys. It just sort of happened. Is it because there was a lack of information?
You know, for better or for worse, since I got to be a bit selective with this book, and as I was saying earlier, didn't feel that people were looking for a comprehensive biography of this person, I felt I could sort of, in eras where I felt his life was interesting. I didn't have to dwell on it. So, yeah, I think I did downplay the 40s. For me, what was kind of interesting is that world of B-movies and exploitation films like She Should Have Said No, which was an anti-marijuana tract like Reefer Madness had been earlier, partly sort of inspired by this Robert Mitchum case where he was arrested for possessing marijuana. So I got sort of interested in that world, those movies that got around the code because they were so cheap, and some of them were supposedly educational, and they were shown in kind of these grindhouses. So I picked up that thread in that chapter, and I picked up the thread of a couple of marriages, including to one person who kind of belonged to that world in a way. She was a L.A. party girl named Abigail Tommy Adams, who had a very sad end and was the mistress of the comedian George Jessel for a long time, and was briefly the wife of my dad in the 40s, and sort of depicting the way his life could have gone if it had continued to spiral downward. So kind of the B-movie kind of noir-esque aspects of his life when he was very seriously into alcohol.
And did you ever get a chance to meet the stars of either Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver, or was that just The Office?
Ozzie and Harriet would come by the house sometimes. In fact, I have a distinct memory once of Ozzie coming to the house, dropping by unexpectedly, and I was little, I don't know, six or something, and I went to the door and opened the door, and he said, "Is your dad at home?" And I said, "No, he isn't," because he wasn't, and just shut the door and went back to whatever I was doing. And later on, my mom said, "Who was that at the door?" And I said, "Oh, it was Mr. Nelson." And of course, he was my father's boss at the time, so this was like not a good move. Ricky Nelson, they were around in our lives. But at the same time, I think my dad had this attitude, especially at that point, having had a life that was very full of sort of Hollywood partying and kind of wanting to have a very separate work and home life at that time, and my mom really wanting that to keep him on the straight and narrow, I think. So our lives were not as immersed in Hollywood socializing after we were born and after he started a family.
Margaret Talbot, let's talk a little bit about your own career. There's a great story about your brother Steve becoming a radical in the 60s and being reminded that he was Gilbert, mm-hmm. and your brother David was one of the founders of Salon. You were a lot younger. Had you always wanted to be a writer? How did that happen?
I'm the youngest of four, so I have those two brothers you just mentioned, and then we have a sister who's a doctor. I always did want to be a writer, honestly, since I was a little kid. I guess part of it is my dad was this great storyteller, and I think we all, Steve, David, and I, are all fond of telling stories. And for me, the way to do it was in written form. My father was much more somebody who was all about telling them out loud. And for me, it was about writing and crafting them.
Well, why journalism rather than fiction?
I can't make up stories. Wish I could. I would love to be a fiction writer. That would be, if I could come back in another life, I would be either a fiction writer or a musician of some kind. Because for me, music brings the purest form of joy. I wish I could do that. But I am bad at making things up. And I guess that's the negative. The positive is I've always loved history in particular. And so to be able to give a sense of the texture of the past is something that I love.
How did you go from that to wind up with the New York Times Magazine and New Republic?
I wanted to do magazine journalism because I like long-form storytelling. And there are a relatively limited number of places where you can do that, and growing smaller all the time. I mean, maybe we're going to have a renaissance in the form of, you know, short books on, you know, Kindle or the iPad. I hope so. Maybe that will happen. So I always wanted to work at a magazine where I would have the space to tell a long story and editors who believed in that. So those were places that I was able to do that. The New Yorker is kind of the ultimate place to be able to do that. So I feel very lucky to be there.
I noticed that you don't have that many long-form works in the recent past, I guess partly because you're working on The Entertainer. You do these little short blog articles. How did you wind up focusing on gay marriage?
Yeah, I've been on leave to do the book, which is why I haven't done longer pieces. But also, they take a while. I did a piece, actually, about gay marriage and particularly focused on the Supreme Court cases. So after I did that piece, and that was a longer piece, and it was focused on Ted Olson and David Boies, the legal team who were leading that, you know, I got quite interested in it. I guess because, to me, there are not that many clear-cut civil rights issues of our day that you really feel like there's I feel that there's a right side and a wrong side of history. And this was a case where I really felt that strongly. And so the idea that I could be chronicling it was very exciting to me. It felt like being part of history and part of kind of the forward march of human progress, not to sound too grandiose about it, but in a way that a lot of other stories are murkier and have a lot more gray areas. This one, to me, is kind of black and white. So, yeah.
Well, you live in Washington. How involved do you get, and how easy is it to break away from Beltway conventional wisdom for you?
I rarely cover politics per se. I've written some about the Supreme Court, and to me, the Supreme Court is a fantastic thing to be able to watch and cover a little bit. There are several legal writers at The New Yorker. Jeffrey Toobin, for example, does a lot of and is the kind of main Supreme Court guy. But I've written a profile of Scalia, and I've covered some other cases, and I love going to the Supreme Court. Maybe it's partly a love of theater. I mean, the Supreme Court is actually I really advise people who come to Washington as tourists to try and go see a case being argued. It's really fascinating, very theatrical. So it's not that hard for me to avoid, as you say, the Beltway conventional wisdom, because I live in Washington, but I'm not really of Washington.
Is Scalia as ghastly in person as he appears to be in print?
He is an interesting case because he has gotten more and more sort of vituperative and kind of nastily ideological over time. And yet, there are a couple of things that as a writer you do appreciate about him. He's actually a good writer, and he has this curious side to him, which is that he's Italian and he loves opera and he loves good food, and his best friend on the court is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which is
really?
Yes, very odd, because of course she's his political opposite number, but they spend time together, they spend holidays together, they go to the opera together. That's one of their shared loves, is opera. So he has some surprising aspects. I think, you know, that's when you're writing a profile of someone, you want to find those. You want to find the paradoxes and the ironies and the surprises to create a full portrait. And I did spend time with him, which he did not permit me to quote directly from. I was able to sit down with him and see his somewhat more personal side of him and use that to inform the portrait.
In terms of Prop 8 and gay marriage, DOMA, do you get a sense of voting on the court?
I think what's interesting is one of the arguments against bringing the case to the Supreme Court was that public opinion was lagging too far behind, and the court doesn't like to be that far out in front of public opinion. And in fact, you know, there's been a lot of criticism over the years about Roe v. Wade and the idea that the court had moved too fast on abortion, and so it didn't resolve the issue. It just kind of inflamed the feelings on both sides. That there was feeling on the court on both sides that they didn't necessarily want to repeat that experience. But I think what's happened actually very fast on gay marriage is that public opinion has shifted a great deal. And of course, with the last election, that was kind of extraordinary because all four states where it was on the ballot, and this was the first time this had happened in a popular vote as opposed to through the legislature or the courts, you know, approved gay marriage. So I think actually that we may be moving towards a position where, you know, Prop 8 would be overturned. And I don't know how expansive the ruling would be. It might just be about California, but it would still be significant.
And who do you think would be the tipping point? Would it be Kennedy? Could it be Scalia? Could it even be Roberts? Because there are also rumors about Roberts.
Yes. You know, Kennedy is who they traditionally look, as, you know, court watchers look to as the swing vote on these issues. And I think you would have to have him. You know, Roberts was a little unpredictable on the, these are not comparable issues, but it shows that he is not necessarily a lockstep jurist, his ruling on Obamacare, the Obamacare case. So, and I think that they do look a lot to where the country is and being
even
able.
Even the right wingers.
I think so. I mean, Scalia, no, he's never going to.
But Roberts, Kennedy.
Possibly, yeah.
Definitely not Thomas.
No.
And Alito, probably not.
Probably not.
So it's conceivable that both Kennedy and Roberts.
I think it's conceivable, yeah.
Speaking about the last election, I've been hearing a lot of postmortems. Do you have any particular take on it? I mean, a lot of them saying that the Republicans have lost the demographic war. My feeling, as much as I'd like to see that, is it's more like they lost the war of getting out the vote and that's it. What's your take?
I think that demographic factor is pretty significant. I heard somebody interviewed, I did not hear who it was, but he was representing the sort of Republican soul searching in the days after the election. And he said, you know, we are in danger of becoming a retirement home for elderly white men. Just with the demographic shifts in our country, the significance of Latino voters and young voters who did come out in this election, and women, I guess I would tend to disagree with you and agree with the demographic argument that there's a real significance to that in the Republican Party. I don't know whether they want to or could step up to that challenge.
Margaret Talbot, what are you working on now for The New Yorker?
I am working on a profile of the director, Alexander Payne, who made Sideways and The Descendants and is making another film in Nebraska. He's from Nebraska and maintains a home in Omaha, like Warren Buffett, divides his time between Omaha and L.A. and is working on a new film that he's making in Nebraska now.
Are you going to keep writing these little blog pieces too?
I will. But I'm getting back into some of the longer pieces.
Margaret Talbot, coming back to your book, The Entertainer, this one character in the book, and I kept reading about her and thinking, this is a movie subject somewhere, the Countess DeFrasso.
Oh, yeah. She is a real piece of work.
She was a girlfriend of your dad, several years older, and she was pals with Mussolini.
That's right. She was this Hollywood grand dame who, you know, was one of these people who threw the parties that everyone wanted to go to. She was American, came from a wealthy American family from the Northeast, but married a count. And in that sort of classic way, you know, he wanted her wealth, she wanted the title. So they made a good trade, and they were both quite content with it. They had a villa in Italy that was ultimately requisitioned by Mussolini, but they kind of gave it to him. It's, you know, they didn't put up much of a protest, and they were friendly with him. They were in that kind of amoral European set that, you know, you sort of associate with Wallace Simpson and Edward as well, who were, you know, just a little bit kind of sympathetic to fascism, or at least unable to judge it with clear eyes. She was not a classic beauty or anything, but because she would sort of take these men under her wing and kind of groom them. My father was the boyfriend in between Gary Cooper and Bugsy Siegel, the gangster. And at one point, yeah, she was involved in some crazy schemes too. She and Bugsy Siegel went to Italy to demonstrate some kind of new dynamite that Bugsy Siegel had heard about, some kind of new explosive that he wanted to sell to the Italians. And apparently several sort of Nazi bigwigs were there. I think Goering was there at the villa at the same time. So Bugsy Siegel said, I'm gonna off these Nazis. This is my chance. Unfortunately, the Countess DeFrasso talked him out of it because she was afraid that she and her husband would get into trouble with the Nazis and Mussolini. So she was an incredible person, and not in a good way, but I guess had her steely charms.
Did you know about her before you began your research?
Yeah, my father had talked about her because she took him kind of in hand, as it were, too. And I remember him telling me a story once. They were both invited up to Hearst Castle together, and she sent him over this entire set of fawn-colored calfskin luggage monogrammed with his name that he could take for the weekend there. So she was into giving gifts to her, mostly younger men.
Did he ever make it over to Europe in the 30s or 40s?
No, he went to Europe once by himself in the 20s when he was a young theater actor, hoping to make it on the British stage. But at the time, the British stage was kind of protectionist and didn't like American actors, so he had no luck there.
Margaret Talbot, after writing The Entertainer, how did writing this book change you?
It changed me in that it made me grateful to be able to write for a living in the way that my father was grateful to be able to act for a living. And it made me want to write books. I loved the process. It's my first book. And it made me regret that I hadn't kept more for my own kids in the way of scrapbooks and photographs and memories like that. But maybe it's not too late.
When is the piece on Alexander Payne going to be coming out?
Well, I'm just starting that, so it'll probably be a while and might be in connection with his next movies. They may hold it until the movie comes out.
Do they pressure you to do any writing over there? Every so often you actually have to show up for work?
Yeah, I mean, there is a New Yorker office in D.C. I usually work from home. You know, it's not like the days when Joseph Mitchell would come into the New Yorker every day for 15 years and, you know, beautifully dressed and apparently not write a word. I mean, that would not work anymore. But there is more freedom than a lot of places, that's for sure.
And you get the calls back from the fact checkers.
Oh, my God, yeah. The fact checking process, which I have come to over many painful years come to really respect and be very grateful for. But it is incredible. It lives up to legend, I would say.
You've been listening to an interview with Margaret Talbot, whose book is titled The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.